I assume the microphone is here and this is a test. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, 3, 2, 1.
Straight.
What is the connection between beauty and virtue, or is there any? And why should there be?
Okay, that's fine. Then we'll just keep on talking away.
Put the treble on for recording.
I really love language.
Treble. That's the opposite of bass.
Now when I want to stop it, I will do this.
My heart broken like a green bottle in a parking lot.
That's wrong.
I buried my head in the sands of America. Flew over America like a damp, ranting bird. Boomed and fiddled while home was burning.
I am not interested in depictions of the actual ocean. I am interested in forms that are so large, you can't see the boundaries. So you just have to believe in them.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 13, Before the Light. Featuring a short story by Mary Terrier, read by Molly Ringwald. A poem by Alex Dimitrov. Plus excerpts from our interview with Toni Morrison, conducted by Claudia Brodsky-Lacour in Morrison's office at Princeton University sometime in 1992.
Single moms who can't find dates on the next Oprah.
Catch Oprah tomorrow at...
Blanche, it doesn't sound like a dilemma at all.
You know, Rose, you're right. Family you can see anytime, but a one-night stand...
I very much want this election to be about the education of our children and our adults.
Toni Morrison has a vision. It is an America where difference is not feared, but celebrated.
Oh, my dream. Which I really like to talk about.
I woke up and the green leaves had doubled in size. The green had multiplied. Something could come from nothing, I remembered. Something could appear suddenly, unexpectedly, out of nowhere.
Interview with Toni Morrison for the Paris Review.
When I first read jazz, I thought to myself, from the very first encounter, it makes us hungry. Hungry for something more, some experience it contains that we did not know we needed and wanted. Once you're in it, you can't get out of it, whoever you may have been before. Did you intend to have this effect on all of us, and did the novel do this to you in writing it?
I'd like to think that I create an appetite and then fulfill it. Especially with jazz, because what music does and what the quality that I wanted to exist was, you know, that sense you get that the musician has more, but he's not going to give it to you. It's an exercise of restraint, a kind of a holding back, not because it is not there, or because one has exhausted it, but because of the riches and because it can be done again. And that sense of knowing when to stop is a learned thing. I didn't always have it. Your novels are known for their extraordinary beauty, the beauty of their language and their inclusion of beauty as part of life. How do you handle beauty in fiction? This is something that has preoccupied me for a long time. I think of beauty as an absolute necessity. I don't think it's a privilege or an indulgence. It's not even a quest. I think it's almost like knowledge, which is to say, it's what we were born for. I think finding, incorporating, and then representing beauty is what humans do. with or without authorities telling us what it is, I think it would exist in any case. The startle and the wonder of being in this place, which is part of our pity, I think, our feeling of being bereft, is this overwhelming beauty. Some of it's natural, some of it's man-made, some of it's casual, some of it's is a mere glance, is an absolute necessity. I don't think we can do without it any more than we can do without dreams or oxygen. Now, what has happened, I think, a great deal is that in conceptual terms, we confuse it or even make it into glamour or into, you know.
Guests, fiction by Mary Terrier. The month after our mother died, our father began bringing women home. It felt like a behind-her-back kind of operation. "I'm going to have a guest over tonight," is what he would say. David and I stayed out in the living room, turned up cartoons, burned toast, kicked our feet up over our heads. I worked long division. At some point, a woman would emerge to drink a glass of water or fix her hair in the kitchen window's dark reflection. The guests left behind nubs of lipstick and gold tubes and leftover food, paper pouches of cold French fries, chicken legs and clamshell styrofoam boxes. They left tampons blooming through toilet paper in the trash can like tiny mice they'd killed, the cottontails pink with blood. I guess when you think about it, everything we do is behind the backs of the dead. I imagine the doctors had removed my mother's sick breasts in one clean cut. Still lovely things I could slip into a bra and strap to my chest. I didn't want the illness, just the shape. If my mother's body could no longer be my mother's, maybe it could be mine. I didn't tell the grief counselor this because she would have said it was normal. This was her favorite word. It made me want to flush the toilet three times. It made me want to take the pictures of grease off the walls of her dim office and bring them home and give them as gifts to Dad's guests. It's not normal to lose your mother when you're 11. Anna was our favorite guest, because she wasn't anything like a mother. Whatever life she and our father might build together could never get bigger than the life we'd had before. Our mother died on Valentine's Day. Anna came over for the first time during spring break. Our father poured drinks. She sat at the table tracing her jeweled nails around water rings and asked for Gatorade powder to mix with her whiskey. Part of a Kool-Aid pouch and some sugar would work too, she said. 10 years ago, Anna said this with disbelief, our father was her science teacher. Mandatory earth science her sophomore year, and later an astronomy elective, which she was enrolled in for 6 weeks before leaving Thomas Jefferson High School. Some bad shit had happened with her mom, and when she moved in with her grandparents, she'd had to start going to Lincoln. A decade later, she ran into our father at the market basket. She said to us, "Mr. C looks exactly the same." She was young enough that she still knew how to win over kids, bringing us frozen candy bars and stuffed cartoon characters she'd won from the claw machine at the grocery checkout. She brought these gifts in a striped pink Victoria's Secret bag that she carried like a second purse. We always asked what she had for us this time, and finally she told us we should just start calling her Santa, which was weird, which I thought was a joke. But David did it, and she smiled. Santa Anna, our father laughed. In April, Anna volunteered to watch us after school while our father supervised extra credit lab work.
When we got home, Anna was at the kitchen table, glossing her lips, watching the local news. She said, "Seriously, how hot is the evening weatherman?" and blinked against the brush of her mascara. I asked how she applied her makeup so perfectly without a mirror. "I just know my face really well." Anna traded the mascara for a pen. She shuffled job applications, brought all of her dark hair over one shoulder. She skipped over the section she didn't like. List all relevant experience. Provide 3 references. What positive attributes would you bring to our team? "Fuck these things," said Anna. She filled out her name, address, and phone number at the top of each application and then moved on to the next one. Anna gave us tattoos. She drew a smiling cat on my bicep. She gave a marker to David, who drew a happy face on his stomach, using his nipples as the eyes. Anna drew a heart on her knee. She shook her accumulation of keys. That was what being an adult meant to me. Anna had the keys to our house, the keys to her grandparents' house, the key to the equipment room in the high school gym. She was the assistant volleyball coach. One key she wore in a silver chain around her neck. She brought it to her mouth and dropped it between her breasts. Anna made dinner when David said it must be time. She stirred a stick of butter into the macaroni and wrapped our bowls in aluminum foil before spooning in the noodles. A good trick, she said, because no one would have to wash dishes. Anna collapsed into the sagging couch. David ate lying on the floor, balancing the silver bowl on his stomach. Anna balled up her foil and threw it at me, muted the TV, and told us that everyone has a worst year of their life and everyone has a best year. You only get one of each. "It is very, very common," she said, "more common than anyone understands until it happens to them, that the best year becomes the worst year, that the best year and the worst year are the same." Anna said, "Some days you wake up and know they'll be terrible." I know, wrong side of the bed, that shit. Sometimes you have a whole year of days like that, but that definitely won't be the worst year. No way. Spring felt stuck. I wanted the days to say something different, something new. I wanted to find our mother in her room after 3 months of her not being in her room or anywhere that I could see. I woke up and the green leaves had doubled in size. The green had multiplied. Something could come from nothing, I remembered. Something could appear suddenly, unexpectedly, out of nowhere. I tried to remember our mother's voice, the loamy smell of her hair before she lost it. I opened closet doors. I looked outside. I couldn't stop looking, though the heavy plastic box of her ashes was on the dresser in our parents' room. I knocked on the box. I kissed its lid. "Knock, knock. Who's there?" "Mom." "Mom who?" Anna came over in a blazer. She wore wedges with ribbons that crisscrossed up her calves. She'd been going to job interviews. "I want to work with that weatherman," she said. "Get me a job at the news." "If you got on TV, would that make this your best year?" asked David. "My best year already happened," said Anna. "What happened that year?" I wanted to know. "I don't like talking about it." When our father came home, he told Anna she looked beautiful. She took off her blazer and pulled her shirt from her left shoulder to show off the lavender lace strap of her bra. He kissed her neck. Our mother had worn brown loafers from the thrift store and a white cotton bra, and then no bra at all. Our father taught summer school. Anna was cheaper than camp. She wanted to give us everything she'd ever wanted as a child. Everything that had been forbidden, too expensive. Long afternoons at the theme park, horror movies, gum. When we got ice cream or Coke, Anna said, "Go ahead and get a large." David said, "I like when Anna's in charge." Anna's favorite thing to say was, "Let's get out of here." She was fun, the kind of mother we might have said we wanted before our own mother was gone. Anna drove us out to the beach. Anna floored it through yellow lights. She didn't put on her seatbelt, so I was shy about buckling mine in the car. I heard our mother's voice in my head making us promise while I dug for the strap. I felt guilty about our mother's inability to keep us alive from whatever quiet place she now occupied. If she could haunt us, she'd have been forcing milk and vitamins in the mornings. She'd have said, "Buckle up." She'd have kept cherry tomatoes in her transparent pockets to feed us when we got hungry on long car rides. Her wide, immaterial hips wouldn't crush them. Anna didn't think about keeping us alive. Anna didn't think about keeping us. At the gas station, we bought everything that would inflate. Anna had our father's credit card. A killer whale you could ride, inner tubes, beach balls, water wings David wore over his fists and uses boxing gloves. "I don't think we can afford this," I said. Anna put quarters in the air machine and filled up the whale. The Gulf Coast stank. Anna said that was what it smelled like inside the earth. The oil rigs were dinosaurs, hungry on every horizon, dipping their faces into the limestone. Anna told me that in our father's class they'd studied hardness. Which rocks can cut other rocks? Which rocks will crumble in your hand? It's a matter of time and pressure, she explained. The longer it's under pressure, the harder it gets. This happens to people too if you don't watch out. I did somersaults into the ocean. We built a sand city. We threw whole squares of bread to a cloud of seagulls and then didn't have any left for sandwiches, so ate the peanut butter out of the jar instead. "Maybe this could be our best year," said David. Anna was euphoric and restless. Anna blew huge, perfect bubbles with her gum that she sealed and took right out of her mouth and threw into the air like balloons. Anna taught us to play poker. Anna started talking nonstop about our father. Over and over again, she said his name. "Well, Mr. C told me. What's it like being on vacation with Mr. C?" "Mr. C, what's up with the heat?" Anna asked our father when he got home from work. "What do you mean?" "Like how everything gets fast. You know, if flowers get hot, they open immediately and then immediately get droopy. Like people, too. How everyone goes crazy when it gets hot." I don't remember what our father said. They went into his room. Anna left after David and I were in bed.
The Paris Review podcast will continue in a moment with the rest of Mary Terrier's short story Guests, read by Molly Ringwald, a poem from Alex Dimitrov, and more from the interview with Toni Morrison, right after this.
My room was the only place in the house with a window unit, so David slept in there on a pallet on the floor. When Anna arrived in the mornings, she lay down with him, and I got down from my bed to join them. Anna asked a million questions, questions I hadn't known I'd wanted to be asked. What our mother had cooked, what she was afraid of, how she smelled, what she thought was funny. Anna laughed. Her bright coral lipstick smelled like fruit. Anna shuffled the cards. "Come on, Anna, cut the deck." Anna was easily distracted, going to the window to look for our father's car. Anna stopped shuffling and took the phone off the hook so that if he tried to call, it would be busy and he'd worry himself back home. Anna went all in on stupid hands, hands where she had nothing, or a pair of threes. She went into our parents' bedroom and tried on our mother's rings. She took us roller skating, and what seemed easy from a distance was not. Once I was out on the rink, I fell and fell and fell. I slammed the slippery bricks of my feet into the ground as I tried to walk. I didn't know how to slow down. I skated into the wall to stop myself, the fragmented projections of the disco ball, a feigned night sky. Anna asked for a cup of ice and rubbed a nub across my forehead, down each of my arms until it melted into nothing. With a second piece, she circled my neck. In July, our father started having new guests over. I wasn't sure whether Anna knew. the heavy, tired-looking woman I recognized from the liquor store. "I'm Leslie," she said. She wore a pink shirt, and her boobs took up her entire torso. Anna and I compared notes on dying. She'd gotten a job working weekends at a nursing home, cleaning old people's mouths after they ate, helping them move their legs out of the bed. She flipped down the footrests of their wheelchairs. She trimmed their mustaches and combed their hair. She encouraged them to chew just a few more times. "Our mom couldn't swallow," I said. "She'd hold the food in her mouth." We'd found her pills, pink and blue, melted in her mouth like colored marshmallows disappearing in cereal milk. The fuzz of potato soup under her tongue. "She slept during the day, but not at night," I said. "Yeah, that's a step toward death," said Anna. "Waking up all alone, learning to live in another way." She asked whether I had ever lived a full day at night instead. "It's like making a life underwater, quiet, blue. Wake up and don't turn on the light. Try to find your clothes and put them on at night. Cook eggs, wash your hair, walk outside. The street is empty. It's like you're the only one alive." One Sunday night, our father cooked pork chops and invited over Nancy, a family friend, a childhood friend of our mother's. She ate hers with ketchup. "You look so much like your mom," she told me. It wasn't clear whether she was there for us or for our father. "This must be weird for you guys," Nancy said. She microwaved popcorn, ripped open the greasy balloon. We all settled onto the couch to watch TV. David with his head in Nancy's lap. Dad's socked feet on the coffee table. Anna came through the door carrying a grocery store pound cake with a tub of icing balanced on top and a plastic sack that rattled with bottled sprinkles, boxes of candy, marshmallows. "I thought we could decorate this cake," Anna said, looking right at Nancy, as though it were Nancy she'd been hoping to do this with. "I'm Nancy, an old friend of Gloria's," Nancy said. "We should all be getting to bed," said our father, and Anna looked at him like, "Who's we?" The next morning, we were at the pool with Anna. She taught us to play sink, name a problem or fear, throw a penny in the water, and watch it drift to the bottom. At home, our father had a plastic juice bottle he filled with change. We'd taken the quarters for ice cream and the pennies for the game. The lap lanes were crowded, but the rest of the pool was empty. Our mother had been a lap swimmer. For 6 months, during her treatment, we'd lived in a big hotel attached to the hospital by a long skywalk. There was a video rental place downstairs. There were themed buffets. There were two hot tubs and an Olympic-sized pool. After her incisions had healed, we went swimming every day. Our mother swam laps in a bathing cap, not wanting the water to touch her bald head, which she admitted would have felt good. I whipped my wet hair in circles. I stood over her, letting my hair fall around her face. She ran her hands through and gave herself little braids. She said, "I have the most beautiful hair in the world. How did I get so lucky?" At the pool with Anna, I watched the swimmers, quick and steady in their lanes. "I sink math homework," said David, dropping a penny. "Shitty jobs," said Anna. David laughed. "Shitty math homework." "Lap swimmers." I threw a whole handful of coins. "Why lap swimmers?" asked Anna. I shrugged. "Hey, there was a quarter in there," said David. "What happens if someone swims down and picks it up?" "Then it's their problem," said Anna. "All the bad guys in the world." David tried to skip a penny across the surface. "100 problems is a whole dollar," said David. I dumped the rest of the pennies in all at once. "Mom, mom, 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 mom." Anna tugged the string of her bikini top. It was as though she could read my mind. "For a second, I thought your mom was back." "What?" "When I came over yesterday, you all look so much like a family. My first thought was that it was your mom." "Nancy is our mom's friend," said David. Summer was almost over when our father ended things. To Anna, he said, "It's just not working," which was something I remember doctors saying. The hospital rooms had been too bright, and we always waited there a very long time. The magazines in the baskets were never good magazines. Our mother falling asleep on the exam table. Anna closed all the windows in the house. Anna lay down across the couch. On our last day with Anna, I promised many things because it felt good to promise. I believed what I said. I'd persuade our father to get back together with her. We'd see each other all the time, and soon. We'd go to the Grand Canyon. We'd always be each other's family. "I'll call you tomorrow," said Anna. She didn't. School started. I stopped expecting to hear from her, and eventually I stopped expecting our mother to come back. I imagined Anna holding her eyelid down to glaze it with shadow, waiting for the weatherman to come on. I didn't know what to imagine our mother doing. Missing her was larger. Missing her was everywhere. I wore one of her t-shirts to bed, and it lost her smell. "Isn't that Anna's?" our father asked. In January, he remarried, and he never mentioned either of them after that.
Why do you write poetry?
Why do I write poetry? I grew up as an only child. I spent a lot of time alone. And I spent a lot of that time reading. And I think the people that I really admired were writers. They were sort of the first people that spoke to me in a way that I sort of felt like I had friends. I wanted to be like them. You know, it was a very kind of juvenile impulse. And at some point, I just sort of realized that I was talking to all these dead people constantly, or they were talking to me. Mm-hmm. And so I think I write because I want to be part of this long conversation and hopefully think alongside of these people. I think that's why I write. Impermanence, a poem by Alex Dimitrov. The first ending, and knowing it would end, I wanted another. Lover, summer, pen with which to write it all down. The first disappointment, which is not remembered but lives in the body, and how familiar it became to take the same walk home or lean over ledges to say my own name when meeting someone. Again and again for the last time, the taste of salt in the afternoon. Flowers for no one, alive and sold on the street. What did I think was promised in being? The way a stranger can finish you off, once only, and never the same after that. After knowledge, how people are being detained and shot with our money, all of which cannot prepare us for death. Of which I am a student, and which is this country's business, the permanence of others. Even our cruelty toward one another will end, and I know that looking at the night sky is me looking at the past, at light that's long escaped and travels alone, but won't always.
Whipping up popular feelings.
Is AIDS
a political disease, too.
Endeavor, go and throttle up.
Go and throttle.
Speaking of edges or boundaries, you have mentioned to me that you begin to write before dawn. Would you like to say something about what the pre-dawn hours allow?
Writing before dawn began as a necessity. I had small children when I first began to write, and I needed the time before they said, Mama. And that was always around 5 in the morning. And then many years later, when I thought that I would try to make a living by writing only, I was writing Beloved, I think, at that time. And the habit of getting up early when the children were young was now a choice, a preference. It was better for me. And I realized that I was clearer-headed, more confident, and more powerful, in a sense, in the morning. And for me, light is a signal in this whole operation. It's not being in the light, it's being there before it arrives.
That concludes the Paris Review Podcast, Episode 13, Before the Light. The pieces that you heard in this episode are Guests, fiction by Mary Terrier, which appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 229, Summer 2019. It was read by
Molly Ringwald.
Impermanence, a poem written and read by
Alex Dimitrov.
It appeared in Issue 227, Winter 2018. You also heard excerpts of Toni Morrison in conversation with Claudia Brodsky-Lacour. The recording was made in 1992, and parts of this conversation appeared in The Art of Fiction, number 134, issue 128, fall of 1993. Special thanks to the Morgan Library and Museum, home of the archive of the Paris Review, which includes the Toni Morrison recordings. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes
John Delore,
Brendan Francis Newnham of Public Address Media,
Helena de Groot,
Craig Morgan Teicher,
Lori Dorr,
and me, Emily Nemens. Our advisory board members are Igioma Azoto, Alexander Chi, Glory Edom, Haley Gates, and Tony Ann Fernandez. We had production assistance from Ashley Warren. Special thanks to Daisy Rosario and Chris Bannon, the Chief Content Officer at Stitcher, and everyone over at TPR HQ. This episode was mixed and sound designed by John Delore, featuring original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospavat, Rob Schwimmer, Shahzad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. A very special thanks to Hendrix Gin, the presenting sponsor of Season 2 of the Paris Review podcast. Oddly infused with rose and cucumber, Hendrix Gin. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, and while you're at it, please leave us a review. And if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our 66-year digital archive, new essays on the Paris Review daily, and the very best in new poetry, fiction, art, and interviews. A beautiful journal delivered straight to your door 4 times a year. Thanks for listening. Stitcher.